Hey everybody, this is Hayes Carl, and you're listening to Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is Chris Shiflett, and you are listening to another fine edition of Walking the Floor. Coming to you from my beautiful hotel room in New Orleans. I'm looking out the balcony right now on the French Quarter, and the sun is shining, and it's just couldn't be lovelier. Been out and about all day, just soaking up, you know, almost everything this city has to offer. So I think I need a nap. But I'm about to head to soundcheck over at the Fillmore. I got a couple of gigs at the Fillmore this week with Foos. We played up in North Carolina the other night, and then Friday, I'm heading up to Nashville to make my debut on the Grand Ole Opry, which is super duper exciting. I'm nervous already. I've been sitting in my hotel room, like running through my songs all week long, just hoping I don't screw them up. So wish me luck, kids. Then after that, I'm heading to Columbus, Ohio for another Foo Fighter gig, and then I'll be back home before this thing ever gets posted. So by the time you listen to this, all that cool stuff will have already happened, and we'll know how it went by then. Anywho, I want to remind everybody to get on over to chrisshiflettmusic.com and pre-order my new record, Hard Lessons. There's all kinds of bundles and cool ways you can pick it up with colored vinyl and autographed copies of this, that, and the other. And in the meantime, you can check out a few new tracks from the record up on all the streaming services. So go check that out, and while you're streaming, feel free to subscribe to the Walking the Floor playlist on Spotify. Got a little dusty there for a while. I was kind of neglecting it, but I've updated it with a bunch of new songs to reflect all the fabulous guests that we've had on the show in the last several months. So get on over there, Spotify, Walking the Floor, subscribe. And let me take a moment to remind you that support for Walking the Floor comes from D'Addario. D'Addario, a fine maker of USA-made instrument strings and musical accessories, is committed to sustainability through the Playback Program, recycling over 1 million used instrument strings. For more information on the Playback Program, visit playback.daddario.com. And while you're doing that, check out Zounds.com. Zounds with two Z's. Zounds.com, where every order $599 and above is eligible for their exclusive 12-part payment plan. And there is free shipping on every single order you place. So get on over to Zounds and get all your music gear and accessories and amps and strings and plectrums and guitars and whatever the heck you need. Zounds.com. All right, let's get on over to today's interview. All right, so I recently had the great pleasure of sitting down with one of my favorite artists out there in the world today, Mr. Hayes Carl. He had come through town on tour, and I got to go see him the night before. Him and his band put on a hell of a show at the Troubadour. And then the next day, I drove out to his hotel, and we sat there in his van and did the interview. I think this is the first time I've ever interviewed somebody in their van, but it's, I think, maybe the best way to get the real sense of like the joy of a van tour, because you can hear like the rumble of the engine kind of in the background while we're talking. It's funny because it was right about checkout time, and they had a gig that night out at Pappy and Harriet's. So we sat in the van for, God, I don't know, probably like an hour and a half chatting. And it was a nice long talk, and then we opened up the door and we were done, and his entire band was just sitting there with their bags in their hands, like patiently waiting for us to finish up. So sorry, Hayes Carl Band, I didn't mean to hold you guys up, but it was absolutely worth it to have this talk that we had. This is Hayes Carl on Walking the Floor.
But it's sure getting hard for other times like these.
This band is fucking amazing. I saw this parked out front of the gig last night, and I was wondering if that was yours. I didn't know if it was yours or if it was Ben Dickey, you know, the guy that was out with you. But I saw it parked right out front, and I was, even without seeing the inside of it, it made me jealous, because I just bought, earlier this year, I knew I was going to be doing a bunch of touring this year, and I was like, I always rent vans.
Yeah.
And it's like a huge part of the touring expense, which is expensive enough as it is. So I bought like a 15 passenger van, took out the last couple of seats, but like, you know, you throw your band gear in there and a couple guys in your band and somebody to help you, and you're just in there like fucking sardines. So I pretty quickly went like, oh, fuck, man, I should have just sprung the extra money and got this Sprinter van. But this thing is fucking, I've never seen one outfitted like a bus. This is amazing.
Yeah, this one is a rental, but I own one, and it's funny how it works. You know, like I started out, my first vehicle was an 84 Cadillac Fleetwood, which was really pimp ride, but not the most efficient thing for traveling across America. And then I ended
was
up...
Was that, were you going solo, or was it just you and a guitar at that point?
I was just solo, yeah, me and a guitar, and I'd roll up to these gigs with five people, but I had this car that
suggested
that I was way more successful and cool than I really am and was. And then I, you know, got some minivans. I had a minivan for 5 years, and a tree fell on it, and then I got another one, and because I was a dad at that point, so it had this dual purpose of like being a parent and being a touring musician.
Yes.
But it sucked, you know, and you couldn't.
I have a minivan parked in front of my house right now.
Okay.
It's my second minivan.
Yeah. So we did that, and then I remember getting my first 15 passenger and just thinking that was the coolest thing ever. And it was, because, you know, it enabled you to tour at a different level, a different comfort level. It had bench seats so we could lie down in them, steal a few pillows from the hotel. You know, you could catch a nap while you're driving, take out the back and put your gear in there. And so I did that for 5 years, ran that into the ground. And then I got a Sprinter. I just bought it empty, just bought the shell and took it to a bus company and had them put some bunks in it. And you know, a fridge and a microwave and a TV. And all of a sudden we were in high cotton. It wasn't a bus, but it was a great kind of in between level of touring. I could stand up, it could serve as a green room in a pinch.
Yeah.
And we could climb up on our bunks, which made the hugest difference be able to recover the day after, especially when I was drinking, and, you know, which I don't really do anymore on the road, but it was a nice recovery chamber. And now, you know, even being sober out here, it's still, you know, it takes its toll, and you know, to have you got a 10-hour drive the next day to be able to crawl up there and catch a few Z's before you get to the show means a lot. And just being able to have, you know, some water and some fruit lying around that doesn't go bad. And
it's funny, the sober touring thing. You know, I've been sober for a long time myself.
Yeah.
And it in a weird way, it's almost physically harder, I feel like, to tour when you're sober. Because you feel everything.
Yeah.
You know, like, when you're partying, you just sort of like, you know, you feel like shit a lot of time, but you know you just got to get to about an hour before the show and then you're going to be all right kind of thing. Where, I don't know, like the little niggling aches and pains that you get from being a touring musician. I don't know. I feel like I'm just much more aware of it now or something.
Yeah, well, I think you are, and that was kind of, I mean, that was part of the point for me, was I felt unaware of my life. I felt disconnected from my life. And, like, I'd been doing all this touring and all this life experience all these years, and I didn't remember a lot of it, and I wasn't present for a lot of it. And part of what I'm trying to do in my life and in general is be there for it and not just have it be a blur. You know, I just turned... I'm 43, and I wasn't feeling as present as I wanted to feel. And so, you know, I figured one thing to help with that might be to not be drunk. And and it does help with it. But like last night, I was just talking with my band about you know, wishing I could. I really wanted to take a couple shots, because in part I was feeling everything, and what comes with that is not always good. That connection's not always, doesn't always feel great.
That's the thing. The only thing I miss is that I don't get out of my head anymore.
Yeah.
I'm never like not self-aware.
Exactly.
On stage.
Exactly. Yeah, and it's like, so with that, I mean, for me comes a certain level of disease or unease, and. You know, it used to be, okay, I'm nervous, or I'm not feeling connected, or the sound sucks, and I just want to be able to get lost in a moment and not feel like this awkward 6'3" white guy who doesn't dance and isn't funny and nobody likes. And you know, that was a shortcut to do that, to, right, to feel comfortable. I mean, I've had a few shots.
Were you having those feelings last night? Because I was at your show, and one of the things that, I mean, I've actually never seen you play live. I've been a fan of your music for a long time, but I've never seen your shows. And I was going to get to this actually later in the interview, but we're kind of there now. But one of the things I was struck by watching you live was how comfortable you seemed on stage, how calm you seemed. It's something that I, as a performer, I remind myself of. I try to remind myself to stay calm all the time on stage, but I never do. I'm always, like, you know, sort of overwhelmed by the adrenaline and the moment and stuff. And I, like, the stories you were telling between songs, seems that you just seemed really, like, I don't know, comfortable, relaxed, like at ease, you know. And I mean, I wanted to find out, like, I know you played a lot, you know, coming up, like in Galveston and stuff, and when they're like some kind of long residency. And I was wondering how that, like, kind of hardened you or seasoned you as a performer to get to where you're at now.
Yeah, the talking on stage, I've always felt, I don't know if I should say more comfortable with it, but for me, it's always been the way to gauge an audience and get to know an audience and for them to get to know me. I think maybe I was a little self-conscious, certainly early on, of my music is not worthy of your attention. You know, I was insecure about my talent level, about my voice, about my songs, because the people I was listening to and inspired by that I wanted to be like, I realized I was not them.
Right.
And
that's a trap.
And yeah, and so I was, you know, I would try and compensate in other ways. And part of that for me was, well, I will give them other things to like about me. And, you know, what I found, I mean, it's not a totally insecure exercise, or it's not an exercise based totally in insecurity for me. It's I enjoy that. And it helps me find a rapport where I can be comfortable and they can be comfortable, and it's interesting to me as a fan when I watch other people, like, I want to be let in. Like, that's something that guys, a lot of the guys that I love, you know, that's a talent of theirs. Ray Wiley Hubbard or Todd Snyder or Fred Eagle Smith, or there's a lot of guys that's a really big part of their show, and it's a part I really enjoy.
It's easy that when you're on stage, I feel like, to completely misjudge what the crowd is thinking.
Yeah.
And to sort of, like, forget that they're all there to see you, even when they're not all there to see you, they're still there to have a good time.
Yeah.
And there's, like, rooting for, they don't want you to suck, and they will, you know.
I actually reminded myself of that last night. I was, again, talking with
LA's
the band.
LA's a tough crowd,
too. Yeah, LA can be
but
tough.
I could see from where I was in the crowd that they were with you 100%, but I know it's hard to gauge that.
Yeah, and for whatever, you know, whatever reason, I often go into situations going, they hate me and want me to fail.
Sure.
And it takes sometimes that reassurance of, let me check with that. Let me find out where they are.
Yeah.
And it's hard to do that musically sometimes for me, because I can't really gauge that reaction. Are they clapping politely? Are they, you know, what are they thinking? Whereas if I can tell a story, I can gauge their reaction and say, okay, they're with me. Or this crowd doesn't have a sense of humor. Or these people are judging. You know, then I can make a more accurate assessment of,
sure,
of what's going on.
That story you told about Southwest just was fucking great. I was laughing. As a longtime married man, I was just imagining what my wife would do if I got on the plane before. It's such a great concept.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, I've been touring a bunch this year, and I sort of exist in these two different worlds, you know. Like, yeah, when I'm out with Foos, it's like a very high-end version of touring. It's very comfortable.
Right.
One of the parts of that is that everywhere you go, there's food. Uh-huh. It's just like these sort of basic, you know, life necessities are just kind of all taken care of for you. But when I go out on my own, you know, doing van tours and stuff, I find, like, every day is sort of, all day long I'm thinking about where my next meal is going to come, mm-hmm, from, or where I'm going to be able to get a decent cup of coffee. Or it's like, that's sort of the, like, my driving focus on the road. I mean, there's the time that you're on stage and it's great, like,
yeah,
what you're there to do, but there's, like, all that other stuff, the other 23 hours in the day. I'm curious, what is, like, what's a day in the life on the road for you?
I mean, it varies somewhat depending on, you know, how far in between gigs. So, like, this West Coast run we've been doing, it's been a little rougher because we've got, you know, 8 hour, 10 hour drives. So
West Coast is tough.
Yeah.
To tour.
And so, you know, that involves less sleep and quicker lunch stops but you know, a typical day is we get up, try and get some breakfast or at least some coffee, get on the road. If we got time, stop for lunch. Sometimes that's decent, sometimes it's a gas station. And you know, then we generally, if we've got time, we'll stop by the hotel and check in, but usually it's straight to the club, load in, sound check, go try and find dinner before the show. You know, which some nights is great and some nights it's, you know, you're in the middle of nowhere, and do the deal, pack up, load out, get back to the hotel a couple hours after the show's over, try and get some sleep. And I talk to friends that they can't really comprehend like how difficult it is, and it sounds weird to complain
sleep
about
thing
it.
Is hard.
The sleep
That's
thing
the
is hard.
Thing
the
me.
Food thing's hard. The lack of exercise is hard.
Yeah.
The driving through the mountains and not having cell signal and you can't talk to your girl or your kid.
Yeah.
Is hard, and just maintaining any sort of normal routine is difficult.
That's it right
and,
there.
So I've got a few guys in the band that are really good about finding the good restaurants and finding things to do. And I'm always sort of battling the desire to check out and just, you know, zone and not be engaged in what's happening, because you have these long stretches of just nothingness mixed in with really hard work.
Yeah.
And you know, my drummer is always good to scout out a good restaurant, and just a few of those things that really help you get through the day without it just being a total wash.
I'm glad you mentioned your band, because your band is fucking great.
Thank you.
Your band sounded so good last night. I mean, you know, you included. The whole thing sounded fantastic. But I was wondering, like, with the folks, first off, seeing any bass player play an SG bass is always, like, a treat to me. You just don't see that too often. But everybody seemed like they really, like, like everybody's role was really important, it felt like, on stage with you. Is that like is this a long time band that you've worked with for a long time? Do they record your records with you, or is this, or are you like the type of artist that throws together a band sort of for every cycle?
None of them recorded records with me, but I've known a lot of them for a long time. So my guitar player Travis Linville is a singer songwriter as well, and he's played with me off and on for almost 15 years.
I interviewed Parker Millsap not too long ago. I think he said he took guitar lessons from that.
Yeah, guy. He did. Yeah. He did. And there's a lot of Oklahoma guys, John Fulbright and Parker and Travis, and that all kind of were connected in some way. And,
right.
And so Travis is one of my good buddies and great player, and Mike Meadows. He's been playing with me off and on for I think probably 6 years, the drummer.
Hmm.
And he plays with Sean Colvin and he played with Willie Nelson recently.
Out
and did a run with Willie because Paul got sick, and so he's played. He plays with a ton.
Did Willie let him play a kick drum or no kick drum?
I don't remember. I don't remember. I never got to catch a show, but. I had to raise his pay when he came back to me. I don't remember that. and then Gina Spigarelli is the bass player, and she's from Austin. And
do you live in Austin?
A couple of years. No, I did for about 12 years.
Okay.
And I basically live in Nashville now.
Okay.
Spent some time in New York, but I'm about to be a full-time Nashville resident. So.
Well, let's talk about your new record, your latest record.
Sure.
Tell the listening public everything they need to know about what it is.
Oof.
This is a curious record, man. Like I said, I've followed you for a long time. And this record has, like, it seems to me it's got, like, it's a great record, for starters.
Thank you.
And a little bit more of, like, an uptime record than certainly your last one was.
Yeah.
But it feels like there's, like, a buzz on it. Like, you know, certain records feel like they come out at just this... It's just the right record for the right time, and yours feels like it's occupying that space right now. And I'm wondering why. Like, what would you attribute that to? Like, what do you make when people say things like it's a return to form and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, that's, I'm not quite sure how to take that. I try and take it as a compliment. I think they mean it's a good thing, but I also think that's a, here's something that we expected of you from the past. Your last record didn't deliver that. This record does on some level, so we like you again. You know, so it's kind of a
did you feel that, what was the reception to your last record? Which is, you know, I mean, yeah, of course, I'm sure you could recognize it's a way more down kind of record. It's been called the divorce record,
or, right?
You know,
yeah. No, it was a somber thing, my previous record, and it was something where I very intentionally tried to do something differently than I had done. I was trying to challenge myself to see if I could create art that was channeling something different for me and was representing, I was using different techniques, and see if I could do it without some of the tools that I had been really reliant on, to see where I was. Am I just this one trick pony, or can I do more than that? And I needed to find that out for myself, because I felt in a rut. I enjoyed what I did, but I looked at, you know, do I want to spend the next 30 years doing the, it's not the same thing, but do I want to quit challenging myself?
Right.
I felt like, okay, this is a time where I either need to decide, am I going to keep pushing myself, or am I just going to settle in and do what's comfortable for me? And so that record was sort of a result of that challenge, it was, you know, it was a somber affair, and you know, it reflected some parts of my life at that time and struggles that I was going through or things that I was dealing with, but you know, there wasn't the humor that has been a part of most of my records before then. There wasn't the tempo that's been a part of some of my records before then. And I think most of my previous records had a pretty wide mix, and that there were ballads and emotional songs, and there were just kind of good time rockers, and there was humor, and there was different things, a little, which was reflective of me and my taste and my influences. And so when I think I came out with this sort of more somber, sort of one-dimensional thing, it caught some people off guard and wasn't what they expected from me. But you know, that's fine. I was proud of the record, and it felt good to prove to myself I could do something different, and nobody got hurt. You know, I was afraid, you know, if I try this and fail, or if I try this and lose fans, like, that'll be the end of the world. And it wasn't. It was good for me. I felt like I grew as an artist and a person, and so that freed me up sort of to, when I came back on this next record, what it is, to not feel like I had to prove that to myself or anybody else, and so I could take elements of that but also revisit some of the stuff that I was more comfortable with and combine it on this record, and I think the result was it was still personal, but it had an energy and a lightness that the previous one did not. And so I think that's what people look at it and they say, this feels, well, I don't know what people say or what they think, but for me, I look at it and say, this is, I am in a better place in my life, and I think that's reflected in the record, but I also feel more able to directly speak from my own voice about the things that are important to me in a way that I hadn't before. And whether that's about my relationship or the sort of the state of the world around me, or how I want to approach life and engage with it. I was writing for the first time, I think, from the inside out rather than the outside in. And by that I mean, when I started out writing, I never felt really secure enough to say, I'm in love, I'm going to write about love, or here's a feeling I have, I'm going to write about that. I wasn't confident in my ability to, as a craftsman, as an artist, to take this core emotion and turn it into something interesting and unique. I felt like it was going to be cliche and generic.
Yeah, I think it's really hard to write about the happy stuff.
Yeah,
when you're feeling good, it's I don't know, it's just so much more comfortable to write about the heavy shit.
Yeah,
and you in a lot of your songs, I feel like you do a really good job of like delivering some kind of darker ideas, but in a way that in like a major key, you know, pretty melody attached to it. You know what I mean? Like, I like that thing.
Dress it up and sneak it in.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, you don't seem like a guy, like, a lot of songwriters are sort of like, feel like they have to like wrap it all up in a bow when the chorus comes and turn into like, there's hope, you know, we're all gonna make it, positivity, and you don't seem like that guy.
Well,
which I like. Yeah, that's one of the things I like about your songs. You
know, one of my songwriting heroes are Townes Van Zandt and Bob Dylan and Kris Kristofferson it's not my first inclination always to to be zippity doo-dah about everything. On this record though, going back to the like outside in, inside out, I finally felt like what I used to do was I'd just come up with a lyric or an idea or something that felt interesting or unique, and then find the story from it and work backwards.
Right.
And say, here's a great line, what is it about?
Right.
And go backwards, and then maybe, you know, try and stumble upon something that felt profound or connected or legit or and then, you know, say, oh, that's what I meant to do. That's just, you know, how brilliant I am. And it was, right. it wasn't always something that, you know, I felt like I could stand behind. It was, okay, this is an interesting song, or this is good, or this is whatever it is, but it didn't feel real, like, come directly from me. And a lot, right. Not across the board, but that's how I kind of tended to write. And with this record, for the most part, I got to a point where I could say, this is how I feel, I'm going to write about it, and I'm going to find a way to make it interesting and unique, but the central point, I know what it is from the beginning.
Right.
And that's the difference for me between this record and some previous stuff is every night when I get on stage, I sing these songs, and it's really interesting to me how I connect with them in a way that I never have before. And when I'm singing about Allison, or when I'm singing about how I want to be connected, or about my frustration with the political world, or whatever it is, I'm singing it, it's like a reminder to myself, these are mantras,
does that evolve over time? Like with your older songs, do you sort of emotionally connect to them in a different way now from a different viewpoint?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, some of those songs some of them I was never that connected to in the first place. It was like fun with words, or just trying to do something that resonated with somebody. But I wasn't really in control of that. And by that I mean, a lot of times I would try and put something down that just I thought sounded cool and had some emotion or effects to it, and then watch what happened. And then say, okay, well, this is how people are connecting to it, so this is what it means to me. And instead of, again, starting from the inside out and saying, this is what it means to me, and I'm going to do my best to relay that to people. There was intent.
Right.
There's an intentionality with these days that I didn't have early on in my career.
I know you write with other people from time to time, and this kind of ties into that. I was going to ask you about this. I've had the experience where a lot of times when I write a song with somebody else, it loses, you know, just sort of inherently in working on it with somebody else and them putting their point of view into it. It no longer becomes like as much a personal story to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a harder time connecting to those songs in the long run. Those are the songs I tend to not play live, or you know what I mean? Like, they just sort of fall off the set list because it's like, I even like, have a harder time memorizing the lyrics. It's weird. It's just like a weird mental block. Have you ever had that with songs you've co-written with other people, where you just kind of feel like this no longer is my story, and I don't know what this is. It doesn't mean as much to me.
Yeah. I can see how that can happen, and it probably has happened with me. You know, co-writing's an interesting process, as you know. But like when I started, I didn't really know that was a thing, or I didn't think of it as a thing. I just thought, here's my life, I'm going to try to relay it through song. And that's the guys that I looked up to, these they didn't talk about their co-writing. They wrote these songs and put them out there and performed them. And then I started co-writing just because I had an opportunity to work with some amazing people.
Right.
So like two of my first three co-writes were with Guy Clark and Ray Wiley Hubbard. And
right. And how nervous were you going into those sessions?
Incredibly. Incredibly nervous, especially with Guy. Because
he had a vibe,
and yeah. He's an intimidating guy, and he didn't suffer fools, and if he
but
thought,
he co-wrote a lot too, right?
He co-wrote, I think, probably every day,
right?
And he was really disciplined about it, but he had no problem telling you you suck.
did he tell you suck
in a roundabout way?
Right, yeah. Right,
so
yeah.
I mean, the first time I got together with Guy, I had a a couple song ideas, but I'd never really co-written with anybody.
Yeah.
I didn't know how you even do it.
Yeah.
I just thought, well, let me come in with a couple ideas. And we went down to his basement where he built guitars, and there's a we're at this work table, and on the wall behind me is this wall of cassette tapes.
Have you seen that documentary? Prior to you going down there and doing this,
Part One Highways.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, so that room that you're talking about, the one in the documentary, that's where you.
I don't remember if it showed up in the documentary.
Oh yeah,
or not.
He's in there like in his little works, and he's got all the cassettes, the whole it's all in there. Yeah,
and there probably is. So it's like, here's Emmylou singing this in my living room, and here's what it's just like this incredible thing that you kind of just stared at and listened to all day.
I get this idea about my girlfriend.
Yeah. It's like, there's a lot of weight, and there's a big picture of towns framed right over the table, so he's looking over you.
Right.
You know, and it's heavy. It was heavy shit for a guy that these are his heroes. And I sit down, and then guy would get stoned, I used to get stoned too, and so he hands me he passes that around. So that's how we start the day, and then he goes, "All right, kid, what do you got?" I said, "Oh shit, okay." And I play him a song idea, and he just kind of stares at me for a second. He goes, "What else you got?" I said, okay, I got two more. I'll play one other. And he kind of like looks at his watch and like, and I realize I'm running out of time.
Yeah.
Like, and then I played him this line. I just said that, I got no rings upon my fingers, no ink beneath my skin. I'll be as clean going out as I was coming in. And, I had that line. I remember seeing it be about some gunfighter or something, and he goes, "We can work with that," and we wrote a song. It was a really incredible experience, just all of it, but in particular to get to watch him work and how disciplined he was and where he put his attention, and how important each word was to him. He was a craftsman. He wrote on graph paper with a carpenter's pencil, and every syllable, every shade mattered.
Mm.
And that was a technique, I had not approached it that way. I still don't really approach it.
What do you mean by where he put his attention? Like, what? Well, did he have like a formula or something
It wasn't a formula. It was just the idea that every syllable, every word, every piece of this matters.
Right.
That this
no
is
fluff.
There's no fluff, and we're gonna trim it and rewrite it until we say exactly what we're trying to say in the best possible way. And we're gonna analyze all that. And so for me, I really early on sort of relied on a stream of conscious technique where I said, well, it's not about craft and hard work. It's you channel into some electricity, some spiritual thing, some thing in the ether, and these ideas come to you. That was the only thing to me that explained how Towns wrote how he wrote, or how Dylan wrote how he wrote, or how John Prine wrote how he wrote. You name it. It's like, these are not things that come from man or earth. These are things that you just, you have to figure out a way to open up to that in some way. And there's a, I think, some truth to that, but what I realized is you have to sit down and write. You have to do the work. You have to practice. You have to get better. And you can't rely on this and these lightning bolts of inspiration. That you got to work at it.
And do you carry that discipline into your writing, like, since then? Do you edit and rewrite and trim and...
I am better at it than I was. I'm still pretty reliant on the bolt of inspiration. But that's where co-writing, to circle back around, sort of, that's where that is really useful for me, because when you're in a room with somebody else and you only got 3 hours or however long, and maybe you know them, maybe you don't, sitting there going, let me you know, just hold on a second while I talk to the gods of creativity, and you know, like, that can be a weird scene, and nobody wants to spend their day watching somebody meditate or get bombed hoping that some brilliant idea is going to come.
Yeah.
You got to come in with an idea.
Sure.
You talk about it and you work on it and you hammer it out and you craft it. And while co-writing can be awkward and uncomfortable sometimes, I find it a really productive experience generally, because you're not wasting time and you're not sitting around waiting for inspiration. You're working, you're doing the work. And
I read a really good quote of yours that was, you said, to be honest, I'm always looking for something else to do other than write. I wish that wasn't the case. And I think that's true of a lot of songwriters. I mean, it's certainly, it's, you know, I spend more time not writing songs,
right,
than writing songs. And, you know, like, I think there was something in that article that you talked about how you clean your house or whatever it is. You know, it's like, I really connected with that. And I was wondering what your take, like, what is it about this wacky songwriting thing that is, like, so rewarding when you do it, and when you do something that you're proud of and really, like, feel like, I fucking crafted that shit, but it's so easy to procrastinate and not do it.
Yeah.
And it's like, no matter how, every time I go through a phase of, like, writing a lot, like maybe around recording a record, I always tell myself, okay, I'm going to just keep going. And yeah. I fucking never do.
Yeah. I just kind of quirk of human nature, I guess, but I'm the exact same way. Like, when I do it, I'm always rewarded with, like, something good comes out of it, even if it's just a good feeling of sitting down and doing work. And then when you make a record and you go, okay, if I push myself, this is what I can accomplish, or if I do this work over here, it opens up certain things. And you know, I mean, again, I'm engaged and I'm connected to what's going on. For whatever reason, I guess it's not just me. It seems to be a common thing with a lot of people. It's easier to check out. It's easier to procrastinate. It's easier to be disengaged. There's a comfort in that, for me, it feels safe to put myself in a bubble of, you know, whether it's, you know, watching movies or shooting the shit or drinking or sleeping or anything to keep you from having to access this part that's real and connected. And it's really strange because, like you said, every time I do it, something that is real or connected, I'm grateful for it. And I have that conversation with myself saying, hey, this was great. What's the problem? Why have you not done this on a consistent basis for your whole life? And I'm gonna have a talk with you, Hayes, and we're gonna change things. And it's really easy to slip back into the less healthy habits.
Well, the business side of being a working musician, I feel like, kind of encroaches on it too. You know, with to circle back to, like, talking about touring and a day in the life of touring.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard when you're in that cycle to kind of, like, find the energy, I think, beyond just, you know, I don't know how involved in
all the other bullshit that goes along with touring and planning the tours and the fucking hammering the your agent to stay on top of the promoter and this and that, you know, all that shit I find very, like, kind of taxing.
Absolutely. It's, you know, you become a small business owner.
It's like the last thing any of us ever wanted to become.
It was not, you know, that was not the vision early on.
If that was our strengths, you know, you wouldn't be in this racket, you know?
Yeah, it takes up a lot of time and energy, and then you're sort of physically depleted anyway out here. And so writing on the road has always been challenging for me. I find, you know, I can sometimes gather good ideas, but actually doing the work, I struggle with, because it's just not the time.
Yeah.
And it's to get time alone, to be able to sit down and focus, to not be scrambling somewhere trying to do something. It's tricky. You're wearing a lot of different hats, and you're just trying to stay sane and alive. And that's not to be over dramatic, but like it can be challenging. I was in Portland the other day. We went to this bookstore, and they had this great coffee table book of the photographer. I'm blanking on his name, but he was with Dylan from like '64 to '65. This really massive year in Dylan's career, and he ended up shooting 3 album covers for him, and it was kind of around the time Dylan's going electric, and he's watching the transition of Bob and how he spent his time, how he goes to the gig, how he spent his day, what he did, his energy. And the takeaway was that he was always doing something and always engaging in something, and writing in his free time, and or reading, or you know, doing things that turning over rocks and searching and exploring for stuff. And you know, I struggle with that, like we said earlier. Like, if I've got a few minutes of free time, my first inclination is to go check out and read the news, or get on social media, or take a nap, whatever. And you know, that can be dangerous, because you know, as an artist, what you're putting into your brain, what you're putting into your soul, that's affects what's going to come out creatively,
sure,
and in every other way. And so again, that's a sort of a struggle that I have, and something I try and remind myself and to work on is, you know, if I'm putting literature and art and human experience and all these things into my system, I have a better chance of being able to have that come out and articulate that in some way and use it for my own art.
That's
if
a really
I'm putting
good
in, you know, Donald Trump did this today, or so-and-so slagging me on Twitter, well, I'm not sure what's going to come out of that that's of any real use.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. Like, I realized this was years ago, at a certain point, that all I ever read were books on politics and current events.
Mm-hmm.
And that was for a long time. And I had to force myself to stop. And I just made a point of, I'm only going to read fiction from now on. Which
you
I
made the break,
for,
huh?
I did for a while.
Okay.
I've since backslid a bit.
I'm
couldn't help myself.
Yeah.
But it was really good. It was really helpful. I feel like that really, like, sort of helped me get, you know, write better songs.
Yeah.
In a weird way. Hey, before we get too off your new album, I guess we've gotten way off your new album at this point, but I did want to ask you about, I love strings.
Yeah.
Who did the string arrangements on your record, particularly on Fragile Men?
So, the record was co-produced by Brad Jones, who I did 2 previous records with, Trouble in Mind and K-Mag Yo-Yo, and Allison Moore, my fiance. And the string idea was Allison's, to bring strings in on it, and the actual arrangement was between Brad and Chris Carmichael, who was a string player and actually played all the instruments. It was just one guy.
Wait, what? Really?
Yeah.
I was going to ask you if those were keyboard strings or if it was a string section.
Nah.
Because they sound like huge and cinematic in that old, like, it sounds like a, you know, 1960s Western or something. You know what I mean? It's got that thing that is kind of hard to capture.
It was really cool to watch, and we did a similar thing on horns. Just one guy come in and can play, you know, four or five things, and so Chris would come in and Brad would say, all right, here's the cello part, here's the violin part, etc. And then we'd, you know, he would take a couple passes at it and we'd tweak it and then put them all together, you know, layer the three or four parts, and it's all amazing to me that people can visualize what this is, what's going to happen, and this part's going to go here and this instrument's going to go there, and you know, we're not all doing it at once. It's, you have to be able to see that into the future of this is where this is going to go, and then this is going to accent it and complement it, and this string will go low and this will go high, and it'll make sense somehow.
Yes, that whole, like, I think it's that four part voice writing or whatever they call it, people learn to arrange. Like, I wish I could just take that and stick that in my brain. It's such a beautiful thing when you hear it, but it's so hard to, like, I don't know if you've ever sat there with like your keyboard on your garage band and tried to like put together a string set. It is not easy.
Yeah.
It's never worked well for me personally.
Yeah.
But you know, I have like so many questions. Feel free to tell me, like, time's up, we gotta go, we gotta get to wherever we're going at any point here. But I did want to talk to you about like growing up in Texas, because you grew up outside of Houston, right? Mm-hmm. How does growing up in Texas, like, how does the culture there, how is it sort of informed by the mythology around Texas? Like, I have to assume, and yeah, I've never lived in Texas, but I've been toured through there a million times, and I think I have a bit of a sense of it. And, I mean, I have to assume, well, I don't want to assume anything. You tell me. What was it like growing up outside of Houston? Which is kind of like, it's the L.A. of Texas, is how I always think of it. Sprawl.
Yeah.
Big.
Yeah.
Huge.
Yeah, that's good. Comparison. So I grew up in the suburbs. I was born in Houston, and I grew up in this small town about 20 miles north of there. I say small. It was 1,200 people when I moved there. It's like 120,000 now. It was like this planned community type of situation. So on one hand, I had that environment. You know, it was a planned community and a suburb, but you know, 10 minutes away was the country, and you know, the place is called Cut and Shoot, and Houston was, you know, just around there, and my family lived in Waco and Marlin and different places, and we traveled a lot and went around Texas, and. You know, it's always been interesting to me, like the pride of Texans, and like why we believe that we are unique and special.
Well, it's the only place in the world that I've ever seen where you see people have like bumper stickers that say like "I heart Texas music." Like nobody has "I heart Idaho music" bumper stickers on. It's like this insular thing.
It is, and it's fascinating, and whether it's related to music or anything else. There's a lot of it's historical, and that, you know, okay, so we were a country,
right?
You know, or. The myth of the Texas Rangers and or you just have all these iconic characters that came from there, but there's you know, in the space of it, just the sheer vastness of the land and the different you know, there's this pioneer mentality, there's this rough and tumble mentality, there is this I can do it on my own mentality that somehow permeates into the psyche, and it's interesting as people move there that are not from there, and I see them adopt it, so you grow up with this is in the background, and musically there's an incredibly rich history there, and that sort of spirit comes out in the way people approach music, and it's also sort of lionized and celebrated in the music, you know, the beauty of Texas, the spirit of Texas, all these things, and so there's so many parts that go into it to create this environment, and it's interesting to think about whether it's, you have all these music venues and you have all of this these opportunities that a lot of other states don't have, and the dance halls are a part of the culture.
But you can, like, you can make a living in on that circuit just and never leave Texas. Make a good living.
There's a lot of people that make more money than I do that don't cross the border. So I mean, it has its own sort of contained economy there, and in the there's a fan base, there are venues, there are radio stations, there are publications, there is a world of people that are identify with that and are attracted to that, and you know, there's 28 million people in Texas or something. Mm-hmm. So if you can tap into that, people can do really well. I haven't really seen that. I mean, other states have it in bits and pieces, but I've never seen it in such a massive way as I have in Texas.
Now, where do you think your worldview comes from? You know, I have to assume you would have been like a bit of the odd man out in small town Texas growing up, just in terms of your politics and sort of beliefs. Did that come from your family? Like, are your parents academics or something?
My parents were both attorneys. My dad's from Waco, and my mom's from Houston.
One of the greatest wave pools in the world right now.
Waco, Texas?
Who would have ever thunk it?
Not I.
No, I'll send you the link. Okay. You can't believe this wave pool. Waco is going to be churning out big air game surfers.
This is blowing my mind. Yeah. I can't connect those dots at this moment. But so I spent a lot of my childhood in Waco. My grandparents were from there. My parents met at Baylor, and my dad went to grad school and then went into the Navy and got out and went to law school. And then a few years later, my mom went to law school. She was a high school teacher and worked with the YWCA and different things. And they were politically liberal. And we grew up in a really conservative town, right, for the most part. And so I think I grew up with a really strong awareness, I think through my parents, of where injustice was, of what was important to them, and how often surrounding us, a lot of these things, the opposite of that was happening, and you know, I don't know if it's just being the one lefty kid in a town full of conservatives or what, but it led to a combination of me wanting to, you know, challenge everybody with my worldview, or the opposite of trying to keep it to myself because I didn't want to go to battle with everybody.
Right.
And that's sometimes when you're in a place that people are not necessarily on the same page with you politically, that can feel like what the only alternative.
Did you encounter resistance to that in the music industry when you were first starting out? Because Americana is sort of like, you know, gets labeled like, you know, country music for liberals or whatever, but like, I found, you know, most business people, and this is true, I think, of any business, are pretty, if not socially conservative. They don't want anybody saying shit that's going to rock the boat or hurt the bottom line or what, you know, like, when you're writing songs like, She Left Me for Jesus or whatever, like, did you get pushback from people sort of at your label, on your team, going, hey, man, I don't think that's going to ruffle some feathers, buddy?
No, I think the label was thrilled because they saw something that would get some attention. And at the end of the day, you know, they're not... they were really supportive, but
there's got to be that time early on in your career where you're you know, you're playing with people, because Americana is also sort of the home of, like, you know, people that have aged out of mainstream country music that now gets called Americana too. So there is this, like, sort of, like, you know, there's a, I think, a big overlap in people and worldview and that sort of thing. I'm just curious, and in the people in the crowd, you know what I mean? Did you ever feel, like, you know, pushback from people on
you know, I didn't, but I also didn't really put myself out there in that way. You know, I certainly early on was just amazed that anybody would listen to me.
Right.
You know, they want to hear my song. So I, while there were times, I mean, early on I was really politically conscious, and, you know, my reason for picking up a guitar was hearing Hard Rain's Gonna Fall and Blowing in the Wind and these political songs.
How old were you when
I was playing? 15.
Okay.
So I went.
How old were you when you started performing? And
in earnest, I was 22. So I went to college in between, but I lived in a town. It was a dry county. There was no bars. There was nowhere to play, really. So I didn't really have any gigs until I got out, and I moved down to this little beach town in Texas called Crystal Beach, and would just go to the bars, ask them if I could put up a tip jar and sit in the corner and play, and they had nothing else going on, and so I said, sure. And so I started working. There were a lot of bars, and I was the only guy who could play guitar and sing at the same time on the whole peninsula there. So so I started getting work, and you know, started working 6-7 nights a week. And but it was, I was doing cover songs, it's safe to say I was maybe not lined up politically with a lot of my audience, but I didn't give a shit. I just wanted to, like, that they would clap at the end. Was amazing to me that I got to do this at all for any kind of audience. And so I was not really anxious to you know, push buttons or anything like that. But so that sort of fire about, I'm going to write about social injustice and politics and all this stuff, that dissipated, where I just want to write music that is about my personal experience and stuff that people can relate to and hopefully enjoy and have fun and enable me to continue to do this.
And were you writing your own songs at that point?
Yeah.
When you first started performing?
Yeah, yeah.
Would you and slip them in there, here and there?
I would, and as a result, a lot of them sort of became about the places where I was or what I was going through, so that people could relate to them.
Right.
And then I thought this will be a roundabout way to get where we were going, but I found this bar in Galveston called the Old Quarter Acoustic Cafe, and that it was the first place where people played their own songs. Like, you didn't play covers at this place, and right. And it was this shrine to Townes Van Zandt and Blaze Foley. And
wait, is that, was, did Townes do a live album from there?
He did a live album at the original Old Quarter, which was in Houston, and it burned down. And one of the owners of that was a guy named Rex Bell, who was Townes' bass player, and he reopened, or he opened a another bar in Galveston called the Old Quarter Acoustic Cafe, which is a smaller thing. And so that became my second home, and where I got to meet these songwriters and watch them do their thing, and started writing my own songs, and met guys who took me out on the road and sort of really helped me understand that there's a world out there beyond the dive bars. And
so you were touring before you were making records?
Yeah.
Like, when did the making records element come in? When did it become like a pro gig? You know, record deals and
I
shit
made
like
my
that.
First record in 2000 and end of 2001. So I'd been gigging for about 3 years before I made my first official record, and I just did it on my own, and then ended up getting picked up by a new label based out of Houston called Compadre Records, and they just did a licensing deal. So I gave it to them for 7 years, and they promoted it and marketed it, and then I got it back after a certain point. And so that was informative in a lot of ways, because one, it taught me what a record label does, and that here's a publicist, and here's how you get to radio stations, and all these parts of the business that I knew nothing about, absolutely nothing about. So it was really informative there. And then also the whole idea of licensing a record rather than they have it. It turned out I own it.
Right.
And
you own your master.
And I own the master, and the power of that, and the financial benefit to that, and
your
that
last
became something that I was
put
important
out yourself,
to me.
Right?
I put it through 30 Tigers.
Oh, it's
but,
through, okay.
But it's on my record label.
Is the new one the same thing?
The new one's on Dual Tone, but it's also a licensing deal. So I'll get it back someday. So that's always been really important to me. I read. When I was a teenager, I'd read these books, I'd watch the Behind the Music, and then I would read these books about country music and songwriting and basically how everybody got screwed.
Right.
And how nobody got to keep their money, and how it was possible to sell a million records and be $500,000 in the hole to your record label.
Yeah.
It's like, how do you do that? Like, that's success.
Yeah.
How do you do that and owe money? And even though there was very little chance of me ever even having a career, let alone one where I had to worry about things on that scale, that really stuck with me of you have to pay attention, because there's people out here that will try and take advantage of it. And if you don't know what's going on, somebody else does, and you're going to be on the wrong end of that equation.
And you've put out records, so you put out records yourself, you put out records through indies, you put out records through, big, whatever you want to call it, music, label services,
yeah.
30 Tigers thing, Lost Highway, which was through, Universal. So it's like basically being on a major label.
Yeah.
Like, which version of all that works best for you? Like, which one of those do you like the best?
I'm still trying to figure it out, There's benefits to all of them. I like when the benefit to having a major label or any kind of label is they have the manpower and some of the resources and knowledge to go and do that heavy lifting and do that work for you. Because I want to write songs at the end of the day. I'm interested in the business and I enjoy kind of keeping tabs on it. But that at the end of the day, it's not where my strength is. And having a label be able to do that is worth a whole lot. Having said that, I remember another thing that I picked up early on was listening to John Prine talk about his label and how he said, I sell a quarter of the records that I made when I was on a label, and I make three times the money, or something. I may be getting the numbers off, but it was something to that effect. Like, you don't have to be as usually successful, and you can still make a good living.
But you do have to be as good a songwriter as John Prine to pull off that business. Well, if anybody listening, that's the takeaway.
Right, right. Yeah. You can own all your records you want, but if you're not selling any of them, then they have fun with that. Yeah. And so that was, for me, my second record was completely on my own. On my own label. I did it with my old manager, a guy named Mike Crowley, and it did really well, and we made some money off of it. And so when Lost Highway came along, I had this great opportunity, but to go work with a semi-major label with this great roster. But I was thinking about that idea with Brian. I said, I've kind of got a little good thing going here. It's just not quite at the point where it's really that profitable. And hopefully I can work with a label that can raise my profile, do a lot of this stuff for me, and have a good experience. And then if they drop me or if I decide to leave, I can go back to what I was doing, but I'll have a wider base to of people that are familiar with my stuff, and then maybe it can get me over a certain hump financially.
There's to throw another one of your quotes at you, because this ties into the whole conversation, and I liked it. I think you're referring to your sort of influences growing up or whatever, but you said, back then my heroes were Willie Nelson and Bob Dylan and Jack Kerouac, guys who I dug not only artistically but for their ethos of getting out on the road, hanging out with the homeless and the heroin addict. Those characters were not in my universe, but I was trying to get at and discover that life. Like, did you, in those early years in this business and touring and figuring it out, did you find that life?
In a sense, yeah. I kind of wish I hadn't romanticized it so much early on. But I grew up in the suburbs, and it was like, it's the kind of place people put Christmas wreaths on their Mercedes and those golf cart crossings, So it was just a very white bread kind of affluent sort of situation, and it was great, actually. It was a nice place to grow up, and in retrospect, I was really fortunate. But like a lot of people with their hometowns, you want something more, and it feels very constricted, and it also felt not real to me, and that you know, now as a parent and somebody just worrying about health insurance, like, I get it's real, but it was a bubble, very much so. And I was, these artists that I was inspired by, they weren't living in the Woodlands, Texas. They weren't right. talking about the suburbs. They yeah. were talking about stuff that sounded infinitely more interesting and real.
Yeah.
And so I was really drawn to that and frustrated by my inability to access that. So I had some things in my life that touched on that through family or whatever, uncle in prison and you know, there's family dysfunction and all that good stuff, but that was sort of kept away from me. And I was interested in it. I wanted to know about the people who traveled America. I wanted to know about the people who sucked the marrow out of life. Yeah. I wanted to know about the people that were dangerous and the ones that were good and the ones that explored all of it and came back and were able to tell that story. Because I thought, what kind of story can I tell coming out of this place? It's sort of a homogenized, one-dimensional thing. I'm not getting the full picture.
Yeah.
And so I really romanticized these guys that looked like they had been out there and had done some things that I really, that sounded romantic to me and that I wanted to do. And so I put that on a pedestal, and that became a big part of my journey early on. Was I want to travel. I want to talk to everybody. I want to live this. I want to get my own bona fides of being an experienced human who's not just been in this one place all his life.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I mean, I had a different set of heroes that I put on that pedestal when I was a kid, but, you know, similar story, like Keith Richards or whoever, you know, right. people that, like, sort of embodied the darker elements of life. That
yeah.
It was, like, really seductive, you know? And I, as a parent now, and as a middle-aged man, you know, I struggle with the exact same thing, because I have my kids listening to, you know, 21 Savage or something, and he's rapping about shit that is really regressive and fucked up, and I have my little white-bread suburban rich kid sons right. who are, like, you know, eating it up. And I, you know, it's that weird thing, you know, you just have a totally different perspective on it. But on one hand, I want to encourage them to be curious about that.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, you're kind of like, I don't know, it's funny. I guess I feel like how my parents felt when they were, you know, when I was trying to pretend I was Keith Richards when I was fucking 16 or some shit, you know
right.
what I mean? But you get there in the end, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, I definitely can relate to that. My boy's 15, and you know, I can still remember some of the conversations I had with my dad about things that I thought were cool and interesting, and I remember his reaction, and I try to remind myself to handle things with a fraction of the reserve and calmness that my father did with me, because my sons say stuff and I was like, oh no, how do I keep it together here?
Yeah, it's funny. My dad, I remember him freaking out because when I was a little kid listening to my brother Stone's records, and I would, like, sing back the lyrics, and he was like, no more Rolling Stones record in this house, and it completely backfired. So I have not made that mistake with my kids, even though I will sit there and go, like, because sometimes my kids will be like, yeah, this guy's, he's in prison right now on a murder rap, and I'll be like, oh, fuck.
Right.
Do you think that's cool? Like,
yeah,
is that cool?
Let's talk about what that actually
yeah.
means.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you so much for doing this today, dude. I mean, I know you got to get to wherever you got to, but I wanted to tell you, when I first started this podcast years ago, you were one of the first people I wanted to interview, and I actually emailed your website.
Oh,
I don't know where, it probably just went to God knows where, into the internet hole or whatever, but I'm so happy that this finally happened. I've been wanting to do this a long time.
Well, I really appreciate that, man. I'm a fan, and I love what you do here.
All right, that was Hayes Carl on Walking the Floor. Make sure you get on over to walkingthefloor.com. I'm going to post a bunch of links so you can see where he's at. I'm sure he's out there on the road somewhere right this very instant. So go buy his tickets, buy his t-shirts, stream his music, etc., 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 and so on. And while you're at it, make sure you get on over to chrisshiflettmusic.com and pre-order Hard Lessons coming soon, June 14th. Sell, 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 baby. All right, that's it for this week. We'll see you soon. Over and out. Adios, amigos.
Yeah, they're coming to go. They're cold and they're hot.